La antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
The February 17, 2022 edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, which is shortly coming your way, is kind of going to be a collection of shreds, patches, bits, and snatches. So even I don't really quite know what's going to be on it, but lots of music by Charlie King, who knows, maybe a few other folks as well, and interviews as well as stories from mostly mainstream media, but we'll be having one particular tale from Kathleen Williams, who's a Sacramento activist who writes for Homeward, which is a newspaper of shock, Sacramento Homeless Organizing Committee. Although maybe they call themselves houseless these days. Anyway, you stay and you'll hear.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin talking a bit about, I'm introducing a long bit by David Rovics, an interview with Cindy Sheehan, I believe, at least that's how it's billed on Rovics' website. I played a lot of music by this singer, who also is a commentator on Counterpunch and other sites. I tend to agree with a lot of what he has to say, and I like the way he puts the words into music. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about my own experience with censorship in Santa Cruz, not by establishment media, which I've come to expect. It's typical. I mean, I usually just don't even get into establishment media that much, or clipped back severely, but or distorted in terms of issues around homeless civil rights or city council bad process or police misconduct. Well, those are kind of the three things that come to mind most immediately. However, I often post on Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, small letters, one word, Santa Cruz. And you can find my stuff there. Generally, I post also often stuff that Keith McHenry sends me, which he doesn't have the time to post or doesn't take the time because he's too busy serving food and dealing with his other Food Not Bombs groups around the world, actually, but also around the country and the state. I don't do it because I'm part of his organization, Food Not Bombs, although I'm certainly a big sympathizer. I do it because I like what he has to say, and I approve of it, and also it's in the same key as what I'm talking about often in the what I write and what I say on this this netcast. So IndieBay has been pretty good to me. I've got hundreds of articles which I put up there, but there was a time when they were censoring my colleague Becky Johnson. Becky Johnson has been a controversial figure to some extent, or was, because of her what I would tend to call Zionist views on the Israeli government, which I disagree with. But my interest was in Becky's writing on homeless civil rights issues and her actions on those issues, which has been almost, without exception, good, very good. Far better than that of a lot of academics who maybe work out charts and get salaries from Housing Matters or get employed by the city and the state and the county to supposedly manage homeless people or provide services that the real service is being provided by people like Food Not Bombs and Santa Cruz Homeless Union and some private charities, although many of them have disappeared with the COVID scene. Anyway, Becky got censored in her homeless materials on a couple of organs, you might say, a couple of places. One was Street Spirit, where they didn't like her associations with right-wing writers. Although her homeless writing, which is the only thing she put forward for Street Spirit, or I think on Indie Bay she would argue about Israel because people would post articles. She, and they didn't like it that she had any at this point of view. They regarded her as trolling. But they censored her homeless stuff as well. And they haven't censored me that much. But more recently, when I attended a rally to report on it mostly, but also to express some support against the vaccine mandates that are being required, that you hear the truckers up in Canada and perhaps now in the United States are going to be protesting against. I don't believe people should be required to vaccinate and discriminated against if they don't. You may want to require them to take COVID tests if you still hold to the view that people who are unvaccinated can spread it more rapidly, more wildly, more dangerously than those who are vaccinated. I don't think that's true. Again, I don't regard myself as a scientist or someone who would give an authoritative opinion and would advise you necessarily to share my opinion. That's just my opinion. And you should form your own opinion. I've been vaccinated myself and boosted, and I haven't had any real problems with that. And I've known people who are unvaccinated who had some really serious problems, and some people who've been vaccinated who've had serious problems with their vaccines. But, you know, that's, I don't know if that's typical, and I wouldn't comment about that. But what I notice is the censorship that happens with people who try to discuss these issues online or on websites, even, you know, traditional libertarian, not libertarian so much, but leftist websites like Counterpunch, which I've occasionally read articles from over the years, and Indy Bay. I put out a flyer at this demonstration that I mentioned that I went to, which was a demonstration at the town clock some weekends ago, a month or two now, which had a lot of women and children and a lot of people who were middle class opposing vaccine mandates, some opposing vaccination generally, but I was more interested in the issue of vaccine mandates. And I distributed a flyer linking homeless problems with that issue, and one sentence apparently so upset Santa Cruz Indy Media that they censored the entire flyer, which I wasn't able to post. I distributed it by hand. If you want to get a copy of it, you can always give me a call at 831-423-4833. And they wouldn't even explain what exactly it was that they objected to, but I kind of assumed that I mentioned something about about vaccinations, in my view, those who are vaccinated being still, if not equally contagious, then contagious certainly still with around COVID. And therefore, might be a good idea to get vaccinated if you're in a vulnerable group, but to force everyone to get vaccinated from babyhood to from womb to tomb, so to speak, is not necessarily the best strategy. It might be maybe a very bad strategy for some people. And it's also, it should be a matter of individual choice. That's the big issue, or one of the issues that you hear the Freedom Convoy up in Ottawa, Canada, talking about. And getting rather roundly smeared for, I believe, in my view, Nazi, anti-Semitic, Confederate flags, violent. Whereas if you tune into their media and you can see a lot of live walking through their protest, it doesn't look too violent or Confederate or Nazi to me. And I frankly am always encouraged. I got to admit it, I'm encouraged by a lot of things, some of which regular listeners here might not agree with, but I'm encouraged that there's such a huge protest, and it seems to be affecting the political behavior of the premiers of the various states or provinces, actually, in Canada, as well as Trudeau, the premier of the entire, I think he's the premier, president, boss, Führer, whatever his thing is. And that means to me that some of us here in Santa Cruz, even at our local level, can learn from this. And we might draw some lessons from this. I mean, I've always said to people who are begging and pleading with the city council, which I continue to spend too much time and attention on, there's another city council meeting coming up next Tuesday, which I will probably be talking about on Sunday, even though it doesn't seem to do much good. And it gives individuals listening the misleading impression that you can actually influence the city council in meaningful ways. I don't think you can. But I still do it anyway. I'm kind of drawn by the lure of power, the notion that, gee, if only I could convince these power people, that would be really great, you know. And then we really should, because you've got to give them a chance. Well, or they're really good people underneath, just like police officers. They're really good people underneath. It's not that people who are in positions of power, whether political or police, are bad people. It is that they are in the midst of and cogs for a bad machine. And insofar as they take their place as role and their roles in that machine, you have to oppose them if you are opposed to what the machine is doing. And you have to characterize them and the impact that they're having for what it is. So if people are getting arrested for sleeping and their vans are being towed away because they're living in them, you know, because some neighbor doesn't like the way they're situated rather than what they're doing, just living there, then you have to denounce that kind of behavior. And if there are individuals who are particularly responsible for that kind of action, you name them. You bring the issue to them in as loud and as clear a fashion as you can. And you might say, well, that is not the democratic process. You wait until there's a vote by the Santa Cruz City Council after people's homes have been towed away. But if you've been watching for year after year and seen what the city has been doing to poor people, in fact, across the country is being done to poor people, you tend to think that direct action is a better approach, at least certainly around specific issues. Anyway, that's kind of the beginning of my rant. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because David Rovics, apparently, he's going to describe what happened to him, I believe. And he already has, I think, in a few items I've played, or at least one item. I played a lot of his songs, but not much of his commentary. And this is going to be, I think, a mixture of commentary and song, at least I hope it is. But he also has on Cindy Sheehan, who was kind of used as a sort of a Democratic Party pinup when the Democrats were not in power and fighting the Iraqi war and fighting George Bush Jr. back in, what, 2005, 2006, thereabouts. But then, of course, when they got into power, Sheehan was discarded. At least I didn't hear much about her. And, of course, the Iraqi war continued under the new and improved management of Barack Obama. And, of course, now under Biden, while troops have been removed from Afghanistan, you still have military operations surrounding the country, and you still have new wars continuing to go on and massive escalation in the Ukraine, and the rhetoric that is really dangerous stuff, considering the nuclear-armed lunatics that are controlling both Russia and the USA. So there's been no change. Anyway, let's hear a bit of this, and well, you be the judge. If you enjoy it, stay listening. If you don't, go do something worthwhile, or just that you enjoy.
Tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
And my apologies, this isn't David Sheehan, this isn't David Rovics' show. It's Sheehan's who has David as a guest, but she's talking about the issues that David often talks about, so let's listen in.
The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we welcome back singer, songwriter, activist, blogger, podcaster, David Rovics, another old friend of mine. Dave and I will be talking about cancel culture and other super interesting things. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with David Rovics. David Rovics, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. It's been a minute.
It has way too long.
As they say. We've gotten into some pretty funny situations together. But tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, because it has been a long time since you've been on the show, even longer than our last interactions with each other.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a singer-songwriter, and I write a lot of essays these days, and first met Cindy Sheehan at the Veterans for Peace conference in Dallas in 2005. Of course, I was doing other things before that, but that was a very memorable weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was already, you know, very much involved with the anti-war movement and global justice and labor and environmental movements as a songwriter and performer. That's my background in a nutshell.
Great. I want to tell a funny story about us. So we were together at the, I think it was a G20 protest in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Gosh. Yeah. I was thinking, which story are you going to tell? I was thinking about DC, but then that one, that's really good. Yeah.
I was going to say, I was there with another colleague that I don't even want to mention his name. But so you and me and the other guy, we were kind of sticking together at this protest, and we went to one protest together where, and another woman was there, I forgot who that was, but We went to
Sarah Wellington, I believe.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah, you're right. I haven't seen her
since then, but I remember her name.
No, I haven't either. So we were at this protest, and all of a sudden the cops started using force to disperse us, and the other guy and I got separated from you and Sarah. So the other guy and I were literally running through Pittsburgh being tear gassed. You know, I had to stop and puke at one time, and we couldn't get back together with you. And so we're running through the city, dodging rubber bullets, being tear gassed. And you keep on texting us that you're in this hotel lounge having beer with a frickin', you know, prime minister of Australia.
Yeah. I mean, at first, we were also being chased by riot cops, two different groups of riot cops coming at us in two different directions. It was like totally out of a comic, you know, like out of a cartoon. But I was envisioning, you know, really bloody, broken bone kind of mess that wouldn't be in the cartoons, you know. And I was thinking, we're doomed. You know, there's two groups of riot cops, and they're coming at us from two different directions. And so, but then we saw this little alleyway, what I thought was an alleyway. And I thought, okay, well, we get 20 more seconds before we die. And, you know, and then we run down this alleyway, and it's a Holiday Inn Express. And so we go in, sit down at the bar, order beers, and suddenly we're hotel guests. And it was just the most bizarre transition. And the cops never came in. It was so strange.
It's so funny. We were like, also like the Australian contingent to the G20 was staying at the Holiday Inn Express.
All 25 limousines full of them. It was so crazy. We're sitting there, and it's like we realized that like half the people in the bar are people that were running from the cops and are now pretending to be Holiday Inn guests. One of whom was Marcus Rediker's son, who happened to be sitting next to me, a professor at the university who I'm a big fan of, and he wrote great books about the history of piracy. And I'm talking with this guy, and I'm like, we find out, oh, okay, he's Marcus Rediker's son, and he was also going to Pisa. He was a grad student, I believe, at the time, and he was running from the cops too. And then we, you know, so then I realized like half of us in there are protesters, and we're all trying to, you know, lay low and be quiet and all this, and just act like chill hotel guests, whatever they might be like, you know.
Well,
then the Australians come, and one in the morning, like the security comes in and they say, hey, all you protesters have to leave. And at the time they come in, we can literally hear people being attacked by the police like 100 feet away. And we're like, you guys don't have guns, and the cops do. We're not going anywhere. and then half hour later, that's when all the limousines full of Australian politicians showed up. And that's when we found out, now we see why they wanted us to leave.
Well, the thing is, too, it's so funny, as you said, it was like this comedy or something. And I feel like they could have made a movie about me and the other guy trying to get back to the Holiday Express, you know, because that was our after, like, and we were never safe from the cops, you know, no matter how far we ran, we were never safe from them. And
it
was all about
everywhere, right? They left the campus. I mean, they were telling everybody to get off the campus, and then they were just chasing us throughout the city.
Right. It was crazy. And so we finally made it back to where you guys were. And yeah, I think that was one of the, even though it was very serious, and why we were there to protest is very serious. Yeah, and it was very dangerous. You know, it was very dangerous to be out there.
I mean, I saw a woman on the campus so violently knocked down from her bicycle. You know, that's a long fall when you get hit hard.
Yeah, we were still together at that point when that happened.
Uh-huh.
And they like knocked her off her bike and then like set upon her. It was a very scary night. And she was just riding her bike through the campus.
Yeah.
I don't even think she was protesting. I think she was a student.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a funny night. But so I'm so glad I reached out to you, because it really has been too long since we chatted, and that's inexcusable on my side. But what the reason I reached out to you was because you were recently deplatformed or canceled from an event that you had been invited to. Do you want to share your experience and your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, this kind of thing has been going on for a long time, but it's just stepped up so much during, well, since social media, and then especially during the pandemic. And it's very, I think, a nefarious, complex phenomenon that has as much to do, I think, with government agents or other disruptive elements that are unknown that are being paid to work full-time doing this kind of thing, and a combination of other people who just have lots of time to spend all their time doing this kind of thing. It is not just a COINTELPRO type of thing. There are definitely real people involved with these kinds of campaigns, including with the campaign against me, which is why it's particularly disturbing, because this kind of mentality has metastasized throughout the sort of left liberal anarchist wings of this society, and really just throughout the society really more broadly.
Right.
And it's just this tendency to find the most minor possible micro transgression. That's a new word. I invented it. to find the most minor possible micro transgression that somebody has allegedly, supposedly, maybe committed, and then turn this whatever it is into a massive issue, blow it all out of proportion, make all kinds of stuff up that isn't true, and just try to get somebody's career ruined.
And more about that in a moment, but let's hear a little music.
Here in Portland, Oregon, there's an image we project. A haven of progressives is what one might expect. But if the city were as progressive as they say, then you should see what passes for city workers' pay. Yeah, what a parsimonious municipality. All of the residents with any sense agree. So we're here to tell the mayor, you can take a hike. We're gonna go on strike. Here in Portland, Oregon, you can hear a lot of talk about social justice, but walking the walk seems more complex. It just sputters and stalls. Time to tell City Hall, what a parsimonious municipality. All of the residents with any sense agree. So we're here to tell the mayor, you can take a hike. We're gonna go on strike. Here in Portland, Oregon, they say we are essential, but the bonus that they're offering just isn't consequential when you consider most of us already had to go move out of town where we can afford to live, you know. What a parsimonious municipality. All of the residents with any sense agree. So we're here to tell the mayor, you can take a hike. We're gonna go on strike. Here in Portland, Oregon, lots of things are very cool. There are movies in the parks and nice immersion schools. Very good for some, but not so much for us. Commuting into town on the number 9 bus. What a parsimonious municipality. All of the residents with any sense agree. So we're here to tell the mayor, you can take a hike. We're gonna go on strike.
And what people do is every time I'm doing anything that's getting any attention, like on social media or in the news or word of mouth or whatever, like promoting a protest, or I'm going to be singing at a protest that I'm promoting, or I'm organizing something or helping organize something, whatever it is, if I'm as a name in the news in any way, then they pounce and they write messages to anyone associated with the event or with me, and they end up I don't know what happened with the DSA event, which it was the Democratic Socialists were having a rally in Portland in solidarity with the city workers who were going to go on strike and no longer, but they were considering the possibility. And we had a rally, which I was supposed to sing at, and then I was publicly on Twitter disinvited from singing at the rally by the DSA Portland's public Twitter account. And it's clearly because the young, impressionable, naive folks involved with groups like that, which is not to say anything, nothing wrong with being young, impressionable, and naive, but they do tend to go together, these things. And I don't think young people are any better at telling truth from lies on social media than older people are. And generally, I think they're probably worse at it because they've grown up with it and they don't know anything else.
Right.
They don't know how much their minds are being controlled by algorithms because they've never known anything other than that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very scary time to be alive, and I find especially young leftists these days to be alarmingly ignorant of a lot of things they should know about, and it's not their fault. You know, there's just no. There hasn't been the kind of infrastructure for ongoing education on the left that you can see quite evident in other countries like Denmark. We don't have that here so much. So it's like every 10 years, it's like everybody has to try to reinvent the wheel, and they're doing a real bad job of it currently.
Well, what I see in cancel culture is... Yes, you know, young people, idealists are involved in it, but I also see a lot of, you know, older liberals who want to, like, they're so mad at book banning, which, you know, I think is absolutely atrocious. Mm. I agree, but, you know, books should not be banned. The Seattle School District, which is pretty liberal, just said that they weren't going to teach To Kill a Mockingbird anymore.
That is shocking. Well, and that was Seattle. When I heard the news, I thought, oh, is this another story about Tennessee? But no, it was Seattle.
It was Seattle. And so I just think that, you know, when you get into any kind of course, when you're teaching school, you have to have age-appropriate materials for your young students or your students to study. But I read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was in fifth grade, and it changed my life. It made me a better person. And I think it made me a better person. So, you know, I think that any kind of banning is ridiculous. But what this says to... when these liberals or even conservatives start to try and cancel people and ban people because they don't agree with everything they say, what it's telling me is they think I don't have the mental capacity to choose my own media, my own things I want to watch or read or listen to. And that really, like, I think it's really a slippery slope when you say, okay, book banning is terrible when Republicans do it, when conservatives do it, but, you know, let's cancel Joe Rogan. I think that that is terribly hypocritical, and it sends a bad message. I think that if we disagree with what Joe Rogan says, then we should be able to say, this is what I disagree about, this is why, but not say that we just want to completely cancel that person.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a complex phenomenon because the sort of cancel culture phenomenon is different depending on, I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here. I'm not sure if it's actually true. Is it different depending on whether we're talking about liberals or whether we're talking about the far left or the anarchists? Do they have the same agenda in terms of why they want to cancel people? I'm not entirely sure because I think there's a lot of overlap. But I mean,
I think you're right.
It's fairly,
yeah.
Like one thing, there's one thing. I mean, one thing I would. Well, my latest piece in Counterpunch is out in today's Counterpunch, but it's on this very subject and sort of trying to deconstruct or unpack this stuff, because I think, like, when we're talking about the censorship versus free speech debate, I mean, I think I agree there shouldn't be censorship, but it doesn't necessarily address the question of Joe Rogan, who I completely agree should not be censored and should be able to interview whoever he wants. But the question with platforms like Joe Rogan's, for me anyway, and for some other people, is the question of why does Spotify see fit to spend $100 million on an exclusive contract to have, you know, they're not distributing his podcast. They host it and promote it and as their number one piece of content, which I'm not saying that's, I mean, you know, maybe it is their best and most popular content, and that's a sensible move for them from a business perspective, but, you know, they are a massive corporation, and for them to be able to have such influence on what we hear in, you know, is problematic. You know, that's what's problem. And also what's problematic with social media are the algorithms. And there again, I'm not for censoring anybody on social media. The problem that I have with these corporate platforms is that they promote disinformation through their algorithms. And that's crazy, and they shouldn't be allowed to do that, and there should be a different – they shouldn't have these algorithms. They should be – I don't think these algorithms should exist. They're manipulating our minds, and they're wrong, and there's, I think if we're going to live in democratic societies where we can control the media environment through laws in some kind of ways, like passing laws around things having to be – you know, you can't just throw around random information unless you can back it up, some of that kind of stuff. I mean – I think the social media feeds should be chronological, like they were when they were first invented, not based on algorithms.
Right.
And if they were, would be all be much less popular, but it would be much more honest and much harder for disinformation to go viral. Not that it would be impossible, because it's always easy for that to happen, because it's always being amplified on corporate media platforms, regardless of what we do with social media. You know, but in terms of the cancel culture. They talk about unsafe space, you know, and this is the mentality that has metastasized. I mean, of course, it's like it's so important to believe victims who have been attacked by or wronged or injured or whatever by somebody else, but you can't just do that indiscriminately with no evidence whatsoever, you know. And what happens when you take this extreme kind of like believe anybody who says they've been victimized or not even victimized, but says they feel uncomfortable, because that's now a form of victimization. If you feel uncomfortable in the room with somebody else. I mean, I was actually told, apparently, by an anonymous person on Twitter who claims to be Jewish, that they don't feel safe being around me because I'm an anti-Semite, which is completely preposterous, because I'm not an anti-Semite. And therefore, like, how can this be possibly even believed for a second as being credible allegation, or, you know,
even if you were, can that person point to any incident where you attacked a Jewish person?
No, well, their evidence for me being an anti-Semite is that I have failed to denounce Gilad Atzmon as an anti-Semite, and therefore, to him and having him on my YouTube channel for my massive audience of 100 people, that makes me an anti-Semite by extension.
And he's been on my show as well. And you know what? That was an early one. Gilad Atzmon was an early kind of test thing. And it was a way to divide. I don't want to say us on the left, because those labels don't mean much anymore. I know I got a lot of crap for having him on my show as well.
Mm-hmm. Anyone who has him on their shows always gets a lot of crap.
Yeah. But it was an early, it was like one of these early test subjects, I think, where it just is like, what? You know, in the beginning when this happened, I was just flabbergasted, you know, at all of these accusations and things start flying around. And again, how is having him on our show, how does that even make us anti-Semite in the first place? They can't really answer those questions.
No, they can only say that that according to their out of context quotes that they love to throw around, some of which are just actually made up quotes. They quote Gilad and they don't explain what anything about the context of the quote, or of course if it's an actual misquote they don't tell us. And then they say, look, this guy is an anti-Semite, and you can tell based on this out of context quotes, and anybody who agrees or doesn't agree that he's an anti-Semite based on this very little bit of information we're just providing is therefore also an anti-Semite. It's the guilt by association thing, and it's and then because you're an anti-Semite for having ever talked to Gilad or for having ever not condemned him for being an anti-Semite, then you're established as an anti-Semite and a Holocaust denier, because he's also accused of that, which is complete nonsense. Then you're also these things, and then you're unsafe to be around for anybody else who is Jewish or sensitive about Holocaust denialism or whatever. And it is just this complete wreckage of nonsense, but then people are confronted with all this information, usually at the last minute, because the tactics, and there are tactics, these are organized people with tactics.
That's a very good point. The last minute. Go ahead with that point.
Yeah, always at the last minute, like a day before, 2 days before, a few hours before, they deluge the organizers of an event with all kinds of sock puppet accounts or other idiots or government agents or some combination thereof, writing dozens of angry, hostile, often bizarrely sexist and other weird messages. But they send, these are not leftists as far as I can tell. I mean, they're it doesn't take long at all for most of these Twitter trolls to start saying the most abusive, horrible sexists. Sexism seems to be their number one go-to thing, and there seems to be clearly a bunch of testosterone damage. Damaged young men. But in any case, whoever it is, I mean, this is what they do. And they overwhelm organizers with all this stuff last minute. People get scared that this is real, that they're going to attack the event like they threatened to do, or they're going to heckle or whatever they're threatening to do. And then they cancel the event. And in reality, I went to the rally that I wasn't allowed to sing at, and I walked through the crowd. I looked everybody in the eye in the whole crowd. I'm quite certain none of those trolls were there in reality. And I'm pretty sure there's only one or two of them in the city of Portland, really. And they just stay home and, look at their phone all the time.
Well, another thing you pointed out in your piece, right after that happened was that, you have worked with DSA in your community and nationally for a long time. You have a long history, and there should have been, with this long history of mutual support, they should have given you the benefit. I don't know if you put these in exact words, but I think they should have given you the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. Because that should be the assumption.
Yeah, you much longer than me, but we have this long history of, consistently standing up for our principles, standing up for oppressed people, and, for social justice and peace. And then to let these strangers just derail not just you, but the event, which in my opinion would have been a better event if you were, allowed to play.
It sure would. There was no music.
Incredible.
Anyway, they didn't replace me with a different musician. They just didn't have music.
Well, it probably would have been hard to find an acceptable
definitely.
There to what they're saying. And that's what I don't get. Why don't we get some breathing space for what we've done, it just, because it's happened to me too. I've been kept as well.
I want to hear about what happened to you. Is in Indiana? I mean, it's the culture. It's the problem. It's this culture of paranoia. They're all scared to be canceled themselves.
Right.
And they believe in this idea of making accusations against your comrades because it's seen as some form of activism. And I'm quite certain that the reason why this kind of thing is so much worse in the United States than anywhere else that I know of is because of the Puritan tradition of of, you know, moral purity, moral outrage. Everything is boiled down to morality rather than, you know, any kind of like trying to achieve anything practical, you know.
Another musical break and we'll be back.
The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, along with France and Italy, Japan and the U.K., the troops came to stop the revolution. Whatever else the lying textbooks say, if they even mention this invasion, usually it will not qualify as a footnote in the story of this nation, in which tens of millions have died since the last time the U.S. invaded Russia, when it was invaded once again. By more armies come to stamp out Bolshevism, whose ranks were filled with German-speaking men, sent to fight and die for their Führer, on a mission to kill all the Russian Reds, brainwashed by the lying propaganda that for years had been stuffed inside their heads. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, armies came to stop this nascent state. They came from the west, north, south, and east. They came from across the Bering Strait. They came with tidings from the White House, from the men of industry, of course. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers made up this sprawling global military force. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, it was an existential threat. When the armies came across the ocean, some people never can forget, such as most anyone from St. Petersburg, Murmansk, Crimea, or Odessa. There are still trucks standing by the road there from the last time the U.S. invaded Russia.
We boil things down to morality in this culture, and it's toxic. And I think it's also the other society where you can find this kind of thing in a big way is Germany, and it's a legacy of the Holocaust. It's you know, which was another form of Puritanism, just a more horrible, you know, even more horrible version of Puritanism than our more slow genocide version of Puritanism here. You know, they did it all much faster with technology. You know, but it was the same mentality.
Well, another thing that really gets me about cancel culture is that, you know, you talk about moral depravity. The people who are really morally depraved are the ones in Washington, D.C., the elected officials, the big military-industrial complex, the media, Wall Street, you know, big pharma. These are the people who are morally depraved. And instead of us working together and saying we don't have to have 100% purity tests to work with other people against the real enemies of peace and justice and equality. You know, so this cancel culture, like I think you said, government agents earlier, I think that it is serving these ruling moral depraved interests. And so they, if they're not part of it, they might as well be part of it.
Absolutely. You don't need to be a cop to do a cop's job, as Ward Churchill said. But yeah, totally. I mean, you know, the real morally depraved, the real actual, you know, genocidal killers, if we want to talk about, you know, people who are perpetuating a Holocaust, I mean, let's talk about the people that run this country who are facilitating the end of the world by not dealing with climate change and by continuing to vote for $700-800 billion a year to spend on the most polluting entity in the world, the U.S. military, and then to, you know, invade other countries, destabilize other countries that, you know, I mean, the influence of the United States around the world is so overwhelmingly negative. And yet these people are too busy attacking their fellow leftists than to do much else with their time. I mean, literally, if you look at the Twitter accounts of my critics, they literally spend all their time criticizing other leftists. You know, so when I first started actually not blocking them, but looking at their accounts before blocking them, then I realized, oh, okay, I'm in really good company here, except for this one dude who actually dedicates his entire life to ruining my career. I mean, it's all he does. But other people have multiple targets. And just recently, last night, I learned that the same Twitter trolls who are targeting me, at least some of the same ones, are also targeting... I'm spacing on his name, but who just... Vijay Prashad, who just, apparently is guilty of not calling the what's going on in Western China a genocide, and that makes him a genocide denier. So now they're, you know, and then they make up all kinds of other stuff, and it's just crazy. So he's in the same week that I wrote something, you know, in Counterpunch defending myself against ridiculous charges, he did the same thing.
Yeah, I'll have to find that link for when I post the show, the Counterpunch article that you just posted. I don't think I've seen it. Another thing about these algorithms, I think that they're, of course, they're using social media to mine our data, right?
Yeah.
Like Google has more on us than the government does.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
They have way more data on us than the government. They know everything about us. And, you know, so they're mining data not just for their own, business, but they're mining it for the government. They are collaborating with the government. And these algorithms are becoming scary efficient.
Yeah.
You know, it's like... I think that they're, of course, using predictive algorithms, if that's a thing. But it's like I could be thinking, gosh, you know, I really need some new bathroom towels. And
yeah.
All of a sudden, I don't even say it. But what I've been writing in social media and emails or what, and I haven't looked for them yet because I just started thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
And all
this just happened to me yesterday. I didn't write about it, but I was talking about it.
Yeah, I start getting ads for bathroom towels. You know,
I'm sure
so
they're listening, and I'm pretty sure I said
sophisticated.
Very, I opted out of any kind of like, you know, if they asked, can we listen to you all the time, I would have said no, but,
right.
You know, what happens is, like, just yesterday I was talking about how we need a new charger for a C-type charger, and then, and I didn't do any searches or anything, just talked about it with my daughter, and then as soon as I opened the computer, the first thing that comes up is an ad for C-type chargers.
That just gives me chills. And what can we do? You know, that guy, I always forget his last name, but his first name is Jaron, J-A-R-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
And he is like he's really one of the inventors of the internet. One of the big ones with either Microsoft or Apple. He's a futurist, there's got to be a new philosophy of internet, you know, and so he's like a philosopher of what's going on in virtual reality internet. He says the only thing we can really do is just disconnect from everything, you know, get off our mobile phones, get off of all social media, don't really own a computer or whatever. And so it's a good ideal, but it's not really practical.
No, it won't do anything for the rest of society. I mean, if everybody's getting offline and closing their social media accounts all at the same time, that's wonderful. I'd be all for it. But if I'm the only one doing it and you are doing it, then that's not going to help the situation at all.
No, just we'll just help ourselves. And
yeah, well, which for your own mental health, that's very valuable. And I've been spending less time on social media and less time consuming news over the past couple, well, the past year, especially since these attacks stepped up, and just for my mental health, which is, you know, it's great for me and it's great for my learning how to play the mandolin, but it's terrible for the movement because I'm a useful asset. And,
absolutely.
And if,
absolutely.
If I'm not doing stuff, that's not helpful to the movement.
Right. And just in last year in 2021, I only use Facebook. I don't have Twitter or any other accounts, you know. And I know I should, because Facebook is really just for people around my age. But
Twitter's the worst.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of your mental health and abusive behavior, it's the worst.
I do look at Twitter, but I don't participate in Twitter. But what happens, last year I was banned seven times.
Seven times?
Seven times on Facebook. So for 30 days each.
Oh, and by Facebook? Not disinvited from speaking at seven
by
events.
Facebook.
Okay.
By Facebook. Seven times for 30 days each.
For what?
Just a variety of things. You know, questioning questioning lockdowns or whatever, and questioning Biden, whatever I got banned for, I got banned for. One time I got banned because one of my friends, she was joking about something one of her nephews did, and I just jokingly put, oh, my God, boys are animals. And I got banned for 30 days for saying that.
Oh, my goodness. What is this seen
that?
As being an insult to males?
Or maybe animals. Wow. Insulting animals.
Somebody's tagging, somebody's watching your Facebook account and reporting you at every possible
opportunity. I'm very closely watched. But the thing about that is, you know, I use Facebook was a reliable source of income for me. If I wanted to promote a book I was selling, or if I wanted to promote an event we were having, and it also takes me out of, you know, takes me out of debates.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was banned. I've been banned for some of the most important things that have been happening around. And it takes my name out of circulation or whatever, because, you know, I have thousands and thousands and thousands of followers on my personal account and on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. So it just takes me out. And that's what they want. They want me taken out, you know.
Really?
And so this is like, since for 2 years, since social media and the Soapbox is the only thing I've been able to do because of mandates and lockdowns, I haven't been
able
to do.
And then you're dependent on these platforms.
Right.
No.
I haven't been able to do anything. And Jerron Lanier argues that for every post you make on these social media platforms, you are making them money.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't see any of that money. And then they can do things like this cancel culture and social media algorithms can do things like you said. It's your livelihood that's being harmed.
And what if like in the old days before computers, what if they were just like disconnecting your phone for a month every time you said something wrong on the phone? You know, would they, I mean, you know, it would be scandalous back then if that kind of thing was a regular practice. But then for a corporation to do that to our main means of communication, main means of promoting events, making any money, I mean, it's, it's scary new world. But of course, also, you know, Facebook, I'm pretty sure you've been on Facebook long enough that you probably had the same experience, that the way it used to be set up with the chronological news feed, if I posted something, anything, a song, a gig, whatever, it would get a lot of attention. Thousands of people would see that. But then, because I have thousands of followers, but then once they changed the algorithm, once they introduced the algorithmic news feed so that it wasn't so any longer chronological, suddenly for me and for so many other content providers out there, and I've talked to many who've had the identical experience, that all of a sudden overnight we stopped getting hardly any attention when we posted anything. And if you want to get any attention, you have to pay.
Right. And so another thing that they have done to me over, you know, time is they tell me that they're putting my post at the bottom of the newsfeed. I'm being punished. So, you know, even when I'm not banned, I get so much fewer likes and shares and stuff than I used to.
Yeah, that's the algorithm. I mean, also, right. I mean, they
but
of course,
they
it may
me.
Be, who knows?
They tell
it might
me.
Be. Oh,
yeah.
They tell you that.
Yeah,
they actually tell you
tell
that.
Me. They tell me. I get a notification. Your posts have been moved to the bottom of the newsfeed for 31 days, 90 days, whatever they arbitrarily decide. And so, talk about before I, you know.
A little music first, and then you get to hear what she wants him to talk about.
If he were wanted by a nation not run by the rule of law, senators and generals had so often made the call that he should be hit with a missile. They had said it on TV. What would you expect from a legal authority asked to extradite him back to this country? If his name were Jamal Khashoggi, he were wanted by a nation which had sent its spies to arrange a situation where he accidentally dies. They'd secretly listened in on all his conversations. If they had explicitly made plans for his assassination, would you write it off as just a strange conspiracy? If his name were Jamal Khashoggi. He were wanted by a nation they so frequently condemn in human rights tribunals held at the UN for torturing their prisoners for the ways they are confined. If the state had a different name, would justice be so blind? Would your courts just hand him over, take him from his family? If his name were Jamal Khashoggi. He were wanted by a nation which committed the war crimes exposed by this reporter so many times. Would you just take the word of the head of state who said he would be so happy to see a bullet in his head? If their main witness was coerced, would you send him to that country? If his name were Jamal Khashoggi. He were wanted by a nation that did all these things and more. If it were Iran or Russia, would you be keeping score? Would you trust their prosecutors, all the nice things that they say about their justice system before they take him away? What if his name were Julian? Would you send him across the sea? What if his name were Jamal Khashoggi? Were wanted by a nation not run by the rule of law.
And that was if his name were Jamal Khashoggi. Of course, he was the fellow who was cut up in pieces for his opposition to the Saudi Arabian regime. And the BBC says on the 2nd of October 2018, not that I'm a big fan of the BBC, mind you, still, at the Jamal Khashoggi, the guy the song's about, U.S.-based journalist and critic of Saudi Arabia's government, walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul where he was murdered. In the months that followed, Saudi Arabian officials said the journalist was killed in a rogue operation by a team of agents sent to persuade him to return to the Saudi Arabian kingdom, while Turkish officials said the agents acted on orders from the highest levels of the Saudi government to kill him. You be the judge. Now back to David Rovics on Cindy Sheehan's show.
We're not running out of time because there's no time limit, but I don't want to keep you for too long.
No,
but
I,
so
I have nothing to do.
Okay. So, talk more about Spotify and how that's affected music, and just in general.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in general. I mean, like, if I still like Spotify a lot better than I like Facebook. I just want to, like, introduce my comments about Spotify by saying that I think Facebook, Google, are have even more horrendous corporate practices than Spotify does. But Spotify has almost like single-handedly destroyed the music industry, and it was already crippled. I mean, it was already collapsed. I mean, the music industry broadly overall between 1997 and 2017 was reduced in size by 5 times. So it was 20% the size that it was before as an economic thing. And this isn't just for the major labels. It's across the board. And then Spotify started their, basically there's a lot of confusing ideas out there, and that's very intentional and partly mm-hmm. also not intentional, but there's a lot of confusing ideas out there. A lot of people think that that pirating music was what destroyed the music industry, and this is not accurate. I mean, it would be a sensible enough conclusion to draw, but if you actually look at the reality, it's not really how it went. My personal experience, and I think it might not be universal, but my personal experience definitely was that for major label artists, loads of people would pirate their stuff, and they were definitely suffering as a result of piracy on the mm-hmm. net. But for artists like me, people didn't do that, and they didn't bother stealing all my stuff like that. And, you know, so when I would give away my music, I could harvest people's emails, which, you know, these days everybody understands how valuable that data is and how useful that is. But at the time, right. It was just, I don't think most people even thought of it, which is why these platforms like Spotify had such, you know, good timing. So then, you know, everybody gets all their stuff is on these music streaming platforms. And for most of us musicians, we already had our stuff distributed through various outlets. That meant that when Spotify opted to drop their paid tier and, you know, in favor of their, you know, or when they introduced their free tier, which meant that anybody can consume the world's music and they have to put up with a little bit of advertising.
Uh-huh.
It meant that was in 2013. And from one day to the next, basically, I lost half my income, and a lot wow. of other musicians did, because suddenly nobody's buying physical merch. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of my audience is young, and they all got Spotify. And of course, naturally, they didn't have money to be spending on CDs in the first place, and any large amount. And suddenly they get all the music in the world for free. And, you know, Spotify sells it like they're paying the artists, and like, this is good, you're supporting the artists by listening. And people talk about it like that. You know, they say, we're supporting you by listening to you. And they say that kind of stuff, and they believe it. And it's not the consumer's fault of the music. It's Spotify's fault for spreading these lies. But nobody's supporting us by listening to us on Spotify. I mean, that's not, you know, it's great if they're enjoying the music, and I'm glad they all have access to the world's music for free. But, you know, for their sake as consumers. But it's in terms of all the independent artists in the world, it's been just absolutely disastrous. On the other hand, Spotify, now that most people in the world get their music from music streaming platforms, and most of those people get their music from Spotify, Spotify can, at this point, now that it's a complete, basically a monopoly, a global monopoly, like outside of China, it now can be kind of useful, but only in the sense of that Uber is useful since there's no more taxis. You know, there are
yeah.
Uber exists, yeah. and we all use it yeah. now, because, you know, if you want a taxi, a lot of towns just don't have any taxis. So your only option is these, you know, these apps, and they work better than the taxis did, and they're cheaper. And so, you know, it's, you can see why they're popular, but from the perspective of the taxi drivers, it's a complete and utter disaster. And it's no different with the musicians on Spotify.
Well, okay, so thank you, because I don't use Spotify. I don't know, and I didn't know. I knew it existed, and I knew Joe Rogan went to Spotify, and then it became to me more of a thing with this whole Neil Young, Joe Rogan versus Joe Rogan or whatever.
Right.
So to just tell my listeners how they can support you, David. That's really important.
Well, these days, artists that are surviving who aren't like big, you know, major label artists are usually crowdfunding, you know, unless they're, you know, independently wealthy or whatever.
Right.
But in my case, it's crowdfunding. It's platforms like Patreon, and right. that's how, you know, I mean, I get my $200 or $300 a month from Spotify, which is lovely, but it's, you know, mm-hmm. not very, nothing compared to what CD sales used to be. And,
especially
you know,
especially with inflation and the prices of everything, you know, it's just, we're working harder and getting poorer.
Yeah. I know. I know somebody whose catalytic converter died in New York, and they say it's going to be like 2 months before they can get in a catalytic converter to put in his car so he can drive back to Michigan.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry.
I mean, that's even with the inflation.
So we got Patreon and...
Yeah, I mean, I started a thing called that I call my Community Supported Art Program, my CSA, like Community Supported Agriculture. But then Patreon came along, and now everybody knows what Patreon is pretty much. So I just say I'm on Patreon. And then these days that's like a shorthand. I mean, so many people, they know it's a crowd. It's a sort of ongoing crowdfunding platform to support artists and other content creators or whoever. And so it's very convenient, and it's a wonderfully run platform. I have no idea if it will continue always to be like that, which is always the problem with these platforms. Right. You never know. Bandcamp used to be much better, and then they started taking a much bigger cut, and they're no longer a very, you know, very good for the artists anymore. But Patreon is a very well run, really, really a lifesaver for a lot of people.
Well, and I think too is that, you know, you have been for a long, long time. I don't even know how long. You've been using your music to bring positive social change and peace. And, you know, you have sacrificed a lot to do this. And, you know, you perform all over the place, and you don't ask for much. And, you know, I know that you have a family, and things are and what you do is to make a world a better place, not to become a millionaire. And so I think that you're the type of artist that deserves this kind of support, because it's not for commercial success. You're sincerely trying to make the world a better place.
And the support I'm getting is just barely enough to pay rent. You know, that's
right.
the kind of support we're talking about, because the
right.
rent keeps going up. You know, it's gone
right.
up 250% since I moved to Portland 15 years ago.
Gee.
So, you know, but also it brings to mind to me, and maybe just random association, but the whole cancel culture mentality that is so rife across the U.S. Left, liberal, whatever, you know, parts of society these days, they kind of, it would be funny if it were not so tragic, but I guess the funny part is that I was already canceled in the United States, not from these idiots, but because of the economics of touring in the United States.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is the music business in the U.S. It's a disaster, and it's partly because of gentrification and the extremely high cost of commercial rent, as well as, you know, residential rent. You know, and what this does is creates a situation where music venues are barely surviving, if they're surviving, and they certainly can't afford to pay artists because they're too busy coming up with astronomical tens of thousands of dollars for their rent every month. You know, so the artists and their workers suffer, not because the venues often don't want to pay artists and workers better. It's because they can't. They're just so screwed by their landlords. And I mean, it's just it's a disaster. And then you add to that, of course, the no more CD sales. And that meant that right. basically from 2013, when Spotify started their free tier, I did a few more tours of the United States that were basically totally subsidized by the fact that I still was making good money touring in Europe. But then gigs in Europe, are, you know, they don't pay as well as they used to either, because, you know, nobody buys merch in Europe either. So at this point, even with Patreon, regardless of cancel culture, I don't tour in the United States anymore. That's why I haven't seen you in years. If otherwise, I'd be calling you up every time I go to California. But I never go to California.
Right.
And I never go anywhere, you know, other than Europe. And I go to Europe a lot, but that's because the gigs, you know, and it's not because, and I love going to Europe, and I'm part of European social movements, and and it's a great thing, and you know, no complaints. It's just that the reason I don't tour here is because of economics.
Wow. Yeah. Did you? I just one last thing. So, the Super Bowl. We just had a big football game the other night, right? And I enjoyed the halftime show, but my daughter told me that the NFL tried to not pay the backup dancers, saying that it would give them good exposure. Does that piss you off? Because how much friggin' money does the NFL have? How much money? They charge $7 million per commercial.
And that'd be, if that were true, if that's true, that's absolutely astounding. My first guess, just not knowing anything about this allegation, is that I don't know if it was in the news or something, but it sounds impossible because there are unions when it comes to things like the Super Bowl and big events that are put on by, you know, companies that do big events with television and radio and stage. You know, I mean, that involve multiple different unions, and I'd be really
right. Well, you would think. My daughter's a pretty reliable source, but right. To me, that's just maybe if that's true or not true, wouldn't surprise me. It surprises you, but it wouldn't surprise me. But the thing is that how much exposure do you need if you're already good enough to dance at the Super Bowl?
Yeah, exactly, right? You can exposure, as they say, you can die of exposure, and that's the kind of exposure they're talking about. Who can possibly afford to dance for free in the Super Bowl while living in a place as expensive as Los Angeles? I mean, it's just complete insanity to, you know, talk about people get good exposure. It's nonsense. You know, in the arts generally, I mean, you can't barely make any kind of a living as a dancer. And if you are making any kind of a living as a dancer, it's probably because you're working for TV studios. And if you're working for TV studios, you're getting paid an average of half of what you would have been paid 20 years ago.
Right.
You know, Netflix, that's what it pays these days with all these different. I mean, there's a lot of demand, and it's the only industry in the arts pretty much where there is demand for you know, actors, dancers, musicians, et cetera, and TV. But TV pays half as much as it used to.
But the people in charge aren't earning less than they used to.
No, they are just, I mean, they're doing this because they've got the whole business. There's no competition with other industries, and so they can just pick and choose all the artists they want. Everybody goes to L.A. who wants to be an artist, and
right.
They're all competing with each other. It's just horrible.
Well, it's like, I just saw a meme, so, you know, you can't pin me down to the accuracy of this, but it said the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts thinks $15 an hour is too much, and he makes $4,339 an hour.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to pay his workers $15 an hour, which is probably true. You know, it's probably, if they say $4,339 an hour, that sounds pretty.
That sounds right.
Accurate.
And then not paying. I mean, and I know, you know, I lived in Boston for many years, and that's where Dunkin' Donuts is from.
Right.
And that is one of the most expensive cities in North America. And it's
right.
Just crazy to be, you know, not wanting to pay your workers. And it's not like they came from Alabama where $15 an hour might actually go somewhere.
But I'm thinking also that the $15 an hour movement started when $15 an hour wasn't even enough.
Absolutely.
To live in the United States.
Now it needs to be, it should be $25 an hour. I mean, with the amount that rent is going up, especially in most of the country, maybe not everywhere, but, you know, it sure should be a lot higher than 15 in most of the country because you can't afford to live on that kind of money. You know?
But isn't federal minimum wage still under $8 an hour?
Yeah, I believe so. It's insane. Yeah.
Do you have a website?
Oh, yeah, davidrovics.com. And my podcast can be found there, too, davidrovics.com/thisweek.
Awesome. Well, David Rovics, thank you so much for being on the Soapbox this week. And it was really great to get to reconnect with you, even if it's in this way.
I know. Even this way, it's been great. Lovely to hear your voice, Cindy.
Okay.
Hope to see you soon.
Oh, my goodness. I hope so. It would be nice to get out of Vacaville.
Yeah.
Okay, David.
Nice to go anywhere. Yeah.
Thank you.
Take care.
more informed and inspired, go to davidrovics.com and his Songs of Social Significance to hear his music, subscribe to his podcast, or become a patron. Like I said in the show, he is very deserving of being supported. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank David Rovics for his couple, almost two decades long friendship, and what he does as a social justice activist and peace activist. And I think you all for listening to and supporting the Soapbox. You can also go to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox and support me or become a patron of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox as well. I am Cindy Sheehan. You have been listening to the Soapbox. Peace out for now.
They get up in the morning to work another day. Turn on the radios to hear the man say, I know the reason why you're stuck. We gotta drain the swamp, clear the muck. If you want things to be better, he said, we gotta paint this country red. So go downtown with flag and gun. That's how the West was won. And the liberal reporter gets up before dawn, rewriting the confusion of the aforementioned pawn, educating us about times before, while omitting the whole class war. How we fought side by side, white, black, and brown 100 years ago. Right here in this town, they talk about the slave patrols, but not about that. You can call it ignorance, but I smell a rat. And the pawns line up and take their sides. In the land of the great divide, a politician runs for office in this country, pretends not to be affected by the money. He stands up for our rights, especially when it's one that's supported by the money men. He tells us not to look behind the curtain, as his voting record makes it absolutely certain he's representing the few. That's what all the millionaires in both parties do. And the pawns line up and take their sides. In the land of the great divide, with us all divided in so many directions, with some getting rich, others plotting insurrections. Someone said a half-truth is worse than a lie, more powerful even than a bullet in the eye. It seems in order to divide and rule, they just amplify the voices of the tools. In the Congress, in the White House, on TV, or in a caravan of pickup trucks invading the city. And the pawns line up and take their sides. The great divide, and the pawns line up and take their sides. In the land of the great divide.
And that's David Rovick's song on his weekly podcast, which he titles Libertarianism is Not Fascism. And it's a song that I guess I suspect might be called In the Land of the Great Divide, at least that's the chorus. I'm going to play some of what he has to say in that podcast, because with the recent activities up in Canada, which actually hearten me rather than discourage me, as I said before, I think we need to talk about it, need to think about it, need to see how applicable it is to where we're at now. And he has some thoughts on that too, I believe, although I don't know if I agree with him or not. Here we go.
Libertarianism is not fascism. You can find this in written form by going to davidrovics.com/thisweek or in podcast form by looking up This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. The slope keeps getting slipperier and the snowball rolling down it is growing fast. The liberal and conservative media has much of global society siloed into one bullshit narrative or another, and most everyone seems to get their talking points from one side or the other. Then their loyal viewers go on my social media accounts and have arguments, talking past each other, neither side making much sense. I want to start out by going way back to set the scene a bit. Each country's history is different, but in much of the industrialized world, the history is similar to the trajectory in the U.S. That is, it wasn't until the 1930s that government programs existed that generally meant people who were too old to work didn't have to die in poverty. This was the beginning of serious government efforts to establish some kind of a welfare state, a conscious effort to lift up the working class and the rural poor so there might be schools some of the kids could go to and laws preventing most of them from working in the mines. This very half-hearted attempt at some form of social democracy in the U.S. lasted for two generations at most. In other industrialized countries, it started earlier and lasted longer, like arguably to the present day. But some things that have been common among so many of these industrialized countries that generally refer to themselves as democracies include the gradual weakening of the welfare state, combined with a rise in the cost of living and a growing gap between the classes. Another thing many countries have in common is the popularity of the libertarian orientation, prior to the growth of the welfare state, especially. Back then, libertarianism was associated with anarchism, which in turn was generally associated with the left. Along with the long-term process of economic stratification over the past...
And we will talk more about the long-term process of economic stratification, but I have just received a call from... what's your name again?
Keith, with Food on Bombs.
And Keith, are you with...
Henry, like the library.
Henry, like the library. You know, we don't get to use that library here in Santa Cruz unless you are on the a student in the university, so I don't know if it's our library or their library.
Yeah, I don't know either.
And I don't care.
The library, except for it's named after a cousin.
Yeah, I know. Well, listen, you're calling in. I thought you might have something you want to report on from down in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so, you know, we received a letter from the city attorney's office today, which was full of inaccuracies, but it was essentially threatening Food Not Bombs. And, let's see, basically, they're like, they love what we're doing, but we are doing it at the wrong place, the town clock, and that they are like, and then they go, our understanding is that Food Not Bombs conducting its activities without the appropriate permits, specifically.
Oh, dear.
And one of the permits was a limited service charitable feeding operation permit with the county, but we already have dealt with that with the county, so that's over. You know, we didn't have to get it in the end. You know, they agreed that that was not necessary. And then they were required to obtain a public gathering and expression event permit from the city, which, of course, we don't do ever.
I don't know if anybody ever has gotten that kind of permit, Keith.
Yeah, no, I would doubt that.
I mean, Huff never got... Actually, Huff hasn't done any protests to speak of, but I'm not aware, for example, that the anti-vax mandate protest at the town clock about a month or two ago that you were at had such a permit, though maybe they did. You know, maybe they may. And I don't know if there haven't been any war protests, anti-war protests that I'm aware of.
Yeah, we had one a few, the 5th.
Right, you didn't get a permit for that.
Yeah, I've never gotten a permit to do a protest. That doesn't make any sense to ask the government permission to protest the government. That's insanity.
Well, you want to...
No, I would never do that.
You want to be very respectful. Also, go ahead.
Yeah, and then the other thing is, of course, we don't get any permits for the right to feed the hungry because it's not, you know, it's always an unregulated act of compassion. So there, we have a policy which we first adopted in 92 at the Food Not Bombs gathering after going through this whole ordeal trying to get a permit in San Francisco, getting the permit only to have it removed immediately through a very interesting scam where I'm pretty certain it was with the city, put a sheet cake on the table where I was assembling all my parts to make a outdoor food facility. This is before a pop-up test was invented. And then the health inspector asked me where the like a fire extinguisher was or something like that. I went to look for that, and then they paid a guy to come up and take a slice of pie, of cake from the sheet cake. And then the health inspector said I had shared a slice of cake without my environmental health permit being properly displayed on my food facility, and therefore they deleted our permit. And they, you know, we violated their little rule, and then so then we no longer had an environmental health permit, which then meant we had no longer the recreation.
Would it be perhaps more accurate to say, who knows why that piece of cake ended up, but the fact of the matter was it wasn't something that you at that moment had any control over of. You had no evidence that it was actually, there was a paycheck in the guy's pocket or anything, right?
My understanding was they just gave him $20 and said go over there.
Where did you get that understanding from?
Just the guy himself.
Oh, really? Well, that's pretty direct.
Yeah. And he didn't know he was part of anything. He just thought, wow, that's great.
So somebody gave him $20 to go put a piece of cake on the area, which then allowed them to say, oh,
it was clear it was a city. It looked like a city employee that brought, you know, it was like, it was weird.
Huh.
You know, the whole thing. Who brought the cake? That I don't know. But it just seemed weird that the guy that came and got the cake told me, you know, that he was given $20 and sent to get a piece of cake.
I got you.
But, yeah.
Now, do you have this letter that the city...
The combination of those things seemed a little bizarre.
Do you have this letter? Do you have a letter that the city attorney had with you? I mean, do you want to read it on the...
I'm going to read you some parts of it. I just read you basically the idea of it, the permit section of it.
Is it a long letter? Is that the problem, or...?
No, it was 2 pages. It's not too long. It says, sent by U.S. mail and email to Keith at Food of Bombs.
Well, feel free to read as much of it as you want.
Yeah, okay. So Food of Bombs operations at Town Clock. Mr. McHenry, first I'd like to convey that the city appreciates your mission and efforts to feed the hungry, and our community have significant concerns about health, safety, and other. And the preservation of city assets has prompted me to write you today. And the city is aware that Food Not Bombs, in parentheses FNV, has been holding large daily from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., which is inaccurate, organized advertised events at the town clock, which is a town park, which is a city park. During the Food Not Bombs events, large congregations of people gather, and there are offerings of food, clothing, and haircuts, which is funny. We haven't had any haircuts there for a while, but... Not at the town clock. In fact, we haven't had haircuts.
Well, they don't mention literature. I don't know what the problem is.
No, no. Food Not Bombs maintains a daily major presence at the town clock with pop-up canopies, multiple tables, cones, caution tape, trash bins, and Food Not Bombs sign mounted on the city tree. Food Not Bombs' all-encompassing presence at the town clock makes it quite difficult for other park users to use and enjoy the area and conduct First Amendment activities at the town clock. This has got to be one of the craziest letters I've ever read. Okay. Our understanding is that Food Not Bombs is conducting its activities without the appropriate permit. Specifically, Food Not Bombs is required to obtain a limited service charitable feeding operations permit with the county. See Health and Safety Code Section 114333. Our understanding is that Food Not Bombs does not have this permit, but please let me know if that understanding is incorrect. Food Not Bombs is required to obtain a public gathering and expression event permit from the city. See Santa Cruz Municipal Code 10.65 and a bunch of other municipal codes. The city requests that Food Not Bombs cease its operations at the town clock until it applies for and obtains a limited service charitable feeding operation permit, which the county and the public, with the county and a public gathering and expression event permit from the city. All at this juncture, Food Not Bombs is operating in an illegal, unpermitted fashion. Should this illegal conduct continue, the city reserves all of its rights under the law to take action to assure that Food Not Bombs either
comes into legal compliance or ceases illegal, unpermitted operations. Additionally, we want to make sure that you're aware that sea staff have observed and received public comments concerning the following. These are funny because these are just random things people have been saying on either calling them up or on nextdoor.com, which is most of the people have never even, you know, like if you go by the town clock for the last 2 years, except for random protests. Okay, so these are the 1 through 10 issues. Parking along Knight Street has been severely impacted with turnout bombs, participants and organizers illegally parking in the metered spaces and failing to pay the meters. Well, we definitely don't pay the meters, but we, there's never anyone parking there until we showed up. Usually one car, two cars maybe on Knight Street, which is like a short little tiny street. Pedestrian pathways within the park are obstructed by food up bombs operations, which has resulted in food up bombs event participants wandering into the landscaped area. Well, they potentially might walk in that, but it has not damaged anything. Then they say trees, shrubs, vegetation have been trampled on or greatly disturbed by food up bombs. Organizers and event participants, including food up bombs, illegally nailing or affixing signs to on trees and shrubs. So that's just, we did put signs on a tree, but it's, that's the way it is, and not on any shrubs. That's kind of funny. Although there's these, we do put signs in the areas where there's some shrubs, but the shrubs are not disturbed by the thing. Plus, you know, we're in an emergency anyway. It's crazy. Food and material debris have been illegally dumped into the water fountain by food up bombs participants. Now, I have only fished out one thing out of the fountain, and that was a gift I had given somebody, and the person didn't like the gift, caught it, set it on fire, and threw it into the fountain when I took it out. let's see. Maintenance issues have arisen due to food debris being lodged in pumps. Now, that's actually completely inaccurate as well. Vandalism has occurred due to food up bombs event participating chipping away at structures, blue tiles of town clock. The chipping of that blue tile was, I think I've seen that maybe 2 years ago or something like that, 3 years ago. Well, it had to be only 3 years ago, before COVID. So, food up bombs participants have pulled up irrigation lines. That's actually not true. Food up bombs participants smoke on site. That's true, but who cares? Food up bombs participants have posted stickers on the park statue and fountain. Those stickers also were there before we arrived, before we started our daily meals. Food up bombs event participants and organizers have shown a lack of respect for the park hours. Which, that's insane.
Well, that would only be the case if you showed up before 6 in the morning and after, I think it's before sunrise and after sunset.
Yeah, and the only reason we're there after sunset is to pick up the trash to make sure that everything is clean at the very end. And that's all. When Bob from Coyote Pressure Washer is there and we're working with him. I guess it's after, it might be as the sun is going down. Yeah. And then I take photos of it to make sure everybody can post them on Facebook so people can see that there's no trash and they go around the whole place. So.
Is that the entire letter or is there more?
No, then in addition to securing proper permitting, the city requests that food up bombs take reasonable measures to eliminate or minimize the above descriptive nuisances consideration there. The city invites food up bombs to apply for public gathering and expression permit for events that food up bombs would like to hold at the town clock. The permit application is found here. As a recipient of such a permit in the past, you are likely to you are likely aware that it contains free of charge. Thank you for your attention. Well, you know, and I wonder, so the reality is, of course, we've never applied for a permit ever, and so that's, like, weird. And that's very strange. It's a very strange thing. Of course, Casey herself, who wrote this letter, had just like in the federal lawsuit around the benchlands, had never...
Casey who?
Casey Renson, who's the...
Assistant DA? Assistant city attorney, right?
Yeah. So she, as you can tell from this letter, if you actually have been at the town clock any amount of time, and before, including before we got evicted from the last place and moved there, that the, the reality is that she never went there, She kind of indicates that she's never been there in the letter, saying that she's getting these reports. Now, Michael had told Bob, the power washer guy, Michael being the parks and, the records and parks department guy that maintains the area, that and he was there today, Michael, and there just seems to be no problem. And, court, he's not reporting, Michael's not reporting, at least from what we know so far, any, that we're leaving trash behind or anything like that. I did get a call from a woman named Tracy. She's apparently 80 years old, lives nearby. She had walked by this morning and to go do something. Then when she came back at about 10 o'clock, she was very angry because there was a guy with a sleeping bag at the town clock. And she wanted me to come down there right now and make that guy leave. I was at 10:33 this morning. I was supposed to go down and make, Tony, Portuguese Tony, leave. Oh, that's ridiculous. Anyway, so my sense, and then there's also this, I think it was up to, it's over 270 comments on Nextdoor.com, attacking, mostly attacking food on bombs.
Where do you get that number from, Keith?
And that's from Julie, emailed that to me this morning.
Julie Scholl.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because I'm not allowed on Nextdoor.com because that's the moderator is Deborah Elson. And I went on twice, and the first time I only posted one thing, which was an announcement for memorial service for homeless people. And that was it. I was done. And then... 2 years later, or 3 years later, I got back on, announced another memorial service, and then instantly removed for also next to that.
Well, it's such a negative subject, Keith. That's how.
We're
trying to look positively about things.
Dead people.
When is this letter dated?
Excuse me?
What's the date on this letter?
Whatever today's date is.
Oh. So it's
February 17th, I guess.
So, I mean, it's interesting because, one immediate response would be, if you want to give us permits, we certainly won't stop you, as you have done before, but please don't misrepresent us as suggesting that we have ever applied for permits and that we ever will, if that's the position of the Food Not Bombs Collective. I don't know if it is right now.
Well, our position, which we've had since since October of 92, is that we will not accept or request a permit.
Right. Well, that's an organization that's, we're talking about 20 odd years ago. What does the current Food Not Bombs Collective have to say about this?
Well, then that was the same thing now. It's the same thing, at the October meeting in Oakland 3 years ago of all the groups in the state of California,
Do they rule what you do, or does your group decide what you do?
Our group decides, but this has been a policy of all Food Not Bombs groups since 92.
I know you've had some, there's been some dissension of a minor sort in the group, and there's always, you sometimes suggest it's maybe infiltrators or government agents. Sometimes it's ordinary people who have not had your experience with permits. and the problems that they are actually used, as it quite clearly is in this case. The permits have nothing to do with any particular problems that are happening. It has to do with, and because they aren't looking, they aren't going to you and saying, can you remedy this particular problem, other than listing a whole bunch of problems and threatening you with revocation of permits. If they really had a serious interest in, you know, actually dealing with a particular complaint, they would bring it to you, either through Mike, the Parks and Rec guy, or through some other person, and you would then find some way of working it out, I would think. But it seems pretty clear that there is no real interest here in, you know, again, I'm not on the scene, and as much as you are, I'm, and of course I'm a partisan, as you are, of this, you know, continued operation of Food Not Bombs, and no fan of city government, so I have a bias. But still, it would seem to me that the arguments that are used here are pretty hollow, that is the problem, and one would hope that this would be seen through by people, and might, however, and this is the real if, would it encourage people to support Food Not Bombs if, in fact, you have, and this was another thing I was going to ask you, you know, police operation moving against you, as, for example, we see police beginning to move in Ottawa to fence off the parliament from the truckers, or as they did, you know, 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I guess it was 2 years ago, to fence off the town clock when Food Not Bombs was serving there at that time and started a 24-hour service to assist with people who are suffering from COVID.
Yeah, the whole thing's pretty ridiculous, yeah. I mean, yeah, but it is funny that they had to kind of switch up their tone a little bit by seeing that they were appreciated the meal. I think that's funny. Of course, that's been kind of a standard comment that these people have been making. You know, like every single person that attacked us online over this whole issue is continuing to say, we really appreciate what you're doing, just don't do it here.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know. And that's interesting because they were making the argument before.
Standard NIMBY stuff.
So it's kind of that's become the new mantra, right? Just don't do it here. But we appreciate it. That was less frequent before. That was usually, you guys should never do it. You're bringing homeless people to Santa Cruz. was the old things that was going on. So, so that's interesting. And that has changed a bit from that perspective.
Sounds,
I guess it's so obvious to choose mass of people out there.
It sounds like you're working it out as, I mean, you know, you just received this letter today, so, you know, I mean, it probably takes two.
Well, I'm having a meeting tomorrow while the group at 5 o'clock. I am going to strongly encourage us not to maintain our policy of never accepting or requesting a permit.
Mm-hmm.
So we've never gotten a permit so far. We're not going to get a permit, I would hope. I can't imagine anybody, you know, I think, you know, when people understand the purpose of a permit, it's to withdraw the permit. Permit and permission are related terms. We don't need permission from the city to do what the city isn't doing, you know.
I mean,
even federal courts and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and Atlanta points out that you don't need permission and you don't need to ask the government for permission to do First Amendment protected activity. And that food is just even the sharing of food without banners and signs and so on is a First Amendment, you know, protected. Now, the time, place, and manner thing, if there was some kind of a, you know, there's still some dispute over that, of course, and some sectors. Sadly, the courts, the Supreme Court now is much more conservative than it was when, so who knows what would happen by the time it got to the Supreme Court. But it probably won't. Never get there. None of our cases have gotten to the Supreme Court. The most recent victory of Food Not Bombs in Fort Lauderdale was the city had to actually pay all of our attorney fees and give money to Food Not Bombs and agree to not bother Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs anymore. So,
well, I think the real victory locally is Food Not Bombs has shown that one, it's, you know, it's, you know, you aren't going to object if they give you a permit, but you're not going to
ask.
Well, you're not, I mean, if they decide they want to throw a permit in your direction, you say, well, that's your business what you do.
We don't.
I mean, if you want to give a piece of paper that says we're permitted, that's fine. We're just not asking for it, and we don't, you know, actually, we don't really recognize its legitimacy. But if you have a problem with something we're doing, please let us know, and maybe we can try to work it out, as you did, for example, when you moved to try to deal with the problem of the plumbing and the various, you know, waste stuff that was going on the previous Food Not Bombs lot, and the problem with the next lot you moved to, which had to do with, you know, I guess the management needing or wanting to move you off the privately leased area. You worked those things out with the people involved, but simply Sieg Heiling the city government just because they've decided they want to clutch you a little closer and instill a little fear in the Food Not Bombs group and their supporters. That is not something that I would support either. I don't know.
Well, it's so beautiful. Cooper came up because I made copies of this and handed it out at the meal. And Cooper was so beautiful. She comes up and goes, "Oh wow, this put you on the map. This is great. Look at, they're recognizing you're doing all these wonderful things, including haircuts, which you haven't done in a while."
Yeah, what about that massage, Keith? You haven't gotten no massage going down there.
Yeah, I haven't seen Jesse in years. But yeah, and then we have the herbal. I didn't mention the herbal tea group that came. That was beautiful. And we've only been there for a short, you know, what, 2 weeks or something like that, less than 2 weeks. So, So the other interesting thing about this, and apparently they did not call you, but they did call the media before sending me this letter, emailing me this letter. Because then I started getting these calls from the media immediately after the letter arrived. I thought that was funny.
So the media wanted to know what was going on, but you hadn't even been sent the letter yet.
Well, I just got it the same moment I'm getting the call, basically. Maybe like, I read the letter. The letter came in about 10 o'clock. Then I got the call from the lady angry that Tony, whose name she did not know, had come with a sleeping bag and sat at the town clock. It's funny. The hours, of course, are not 11 a.m. to 5. We are lucky to get there at 12 noon and get things going. I mean, we do get there at 12 noon, absolutely, every time.
Well, you know, there has been an increasing restriction on public access to the town clock. It used to be a 24-hour event or a 24-hour place that people could come and do protest. It was not a park. It was declared a park in order to remove protesters who were there in 1991 against the Iraqi war and against abuses around the homeless. That was against Joe Selinsky, Wanton Dave Jacobs, Robert Flory, and others who were there at the town clock doing that. And they have then they turned it into a park, supposedly, which you had to be. It was open from I think 6 in the morning until midnight. And they then used that closing hour to launch a direct attack that created a riot downtown on New Year's Eve. That was in 1993-94, New Year's Eve. And then the history then was after that, they, I think it was more recently, obviously, I'm not sure when it was, but they suddenly decided it's a park from sunrise to sunset. And thereafter, for most of the time in the winter, for example, it's closed, and that presumably was an attempt to deter people from gathering there, just as they've done the same thing at the entire City Hall complex, all around the county building, although that is somewhat loosened up in COVID times, I guess. I haven't noticed any tickets coming in, but people, unfortunately, have also been very, very domesticated in that regard, or intimidated, if you will, and groups like the ACLU have taken no action to try to, you know, resist this, essentially declaring public spaces increasingly inaccessible to folks.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. And you know, the Cylon Avatar, the Hololive, you know, it's just to be expected. They're going to...
You're referring to the city council, of course.
Yeah, the Celluloid Avatars is going to be having a meeting on March 8th to discuss their great plans that they came up with in the last 6 weeks for maybe it's more than that. It'll be like 8 weeks by the time they announce whatever this plan is that they've been working on, this big plan for 3 years for dealing with homeless people.
And there is a city council meeting next Tuesday as well.
Tuesday, March 8th, whatever that is.
Tuesday will be March 22nd, February 22nd. So.
The one that was announced in the paper was March 8th.
Yeah, that's the city manager's homeless czar plan, I believe.
Report on their plans for a three-year plan. So, anyway, you got that. I'm going to have to go because now I have my workshop on writing that I've got to do.
Well, tomorrow at 5 on Friday the 18th at the Red Church, you're having a meeting which is open to the public?
Open to the public, and we're hoping that, we just want to throw around ideas about what our response. I don't want to write a letter back to the city or something about some, you know, our response. I mean, my personal response for sure is that, you know, is to reiterate that what we agreed to in Oakland was we would never accept or request a permit, to share food, that it was an unregulated act of compassion, always an unregulated act of compassion, and that we continue to clean up the area. We actually had to increase the pickups of our dumpster when we ended up over at where University Copy was, and until the hedge fund that was owning it from Delaware, registered in Delaware.
People should come to your meeting tomorrow, to the meeting of the Food Not Bombs group, if they wish to be supportive, and also to keep their eyes peeled on the emails, because I presume you'll be sending something out. I'd encourage you to send me that letter. Do you mind if we post it?
You can post it. I've sent it to you. So.
All right. I will check it out. And in the meantime, shape up.
Okay. Well, have fun out there.
Do everything the city says, please. All right.
Talk to you.
Bye-bye. And, of course, that ran out the time for this Libertarianism is Not Fascism discussion by David Rovics. But there is always a Sunday show that usually follows the Thursday show. I encourage you to check that out. Plus, I'm going to be at this meeting at 5 o'clock tomorrow, because I think they're coming at us again, I'm afraid, and it doesn't sound good. But, there's a lot of bluffing, blustering, and bullying that goes on that has little to do with anything of substance and simply really requires the community to make a robust response to that, or at least be prepared to make a robust response if there's an actual threat to food, not bombs, but this more than bluster. The one thing I wanted to read before we leave this particular netcast here is an article by Kathleen Williams. Kathleen Williams is an activist who is also an attorney, I believe, who is in Sacramento and has written for a publication called Homeward, which is the publication of the Sacramento Homeless Organizing Committee. And she wrote I'm hoping to have her on to be interviewed. We'd actually arranged to do it, but then I screwed up, and I'm going to have to try to reschedule, but I think that can still be done. The article is called The Fight of Unhoused People for the Right to Live Intensifies as the Need for Housing Becomes Undeniable. She's writing from her Sacramento base. The city's attack on unhoused people living in vehicles. A devastating attack on the homeless was carried out this December by the destruction of the only homes that many unhoused people have in Sacramento, California. Hundreds of people were impacted after the city tagged the vehicles where they were living on Commerce Circle, a secluded side street. The city towed 18 cars and RVs that stayed parked because their unhoused owners did not have the money to get them running, even as storms brought freezing rain to the region. Many more vehicles, 3,000 total, have been identified by the city and targeted for towing. Sacramento's Services Not Sweeps Coalition, a coalition of activist groups, the Sacramento Homeless Union, and the Sacramento Homeless Organizing Committee, Democratic Socialists of America, along with others, protested the city's actions at the city council meeting on December 14th. So apparently they may have open city council meetings there instead of zoomy-boomy ones like we have here, although I don't know. Activists said the crackdown could not come at a worse time, with all shelters full on any given night, temperatures forecast to dip into the 30s this week, rain in the forecast Saturday and Sunday, and no warming centers yet open. Four homeless people in Sacramento County died of hypothermia last winter. With temperatures dropping, they are giving permission to remove the only shelter that families have, said Crystal Sanchez, president of the Sacramento Homeless Union. We are getting reports of children as young as 2 months old to seniors losing RVs. The streets of Sacramento are extremely dangerous, not only due to the elements of weather, but of physical harm. That's a quote from Teresa Clift of the Sacramento Bee. According to Katia Valenzuela, the progressive councilwoman elected last year in a campaign that was responsive to the needs of the working and poor neighborhoods in the central city, quote, "We should not be wasting resources on further traumatizing and harming people who have no place to go, particularly when those actions take away the only shelter, the RVs and the vehicles, that people have during the rainy and cold season, which can be life-threatening to people living outdoors," Valenzuela said in the post quoted in the Sacramento Bee. And, of course, that's also true here in Santa Cruz. We've had increasing reports at the Huff meeting of people whose vehicles are being towed or ticketed in increasing numbers. I've been getting those reports and playing some of them on this netcast. But unfortunately, time is kind of running out, and rather than rush it or extend it too far, I'm going to probably begin again to read this letter or read from where I've left off on the Sunday show, hoping we will also be able to perhaps actually hear from Kathleen Williams herself and do a little dialogue on that, though there's not much time between now and Sunday, so we'll see. There's also going to be an analysis, I hope, of the upcoming shitty council agenda, which you can find yourself if you want to go look online. It should be up Thursday night, Friday morning. And Scott Graham, Scope It Out Scott as I call him, is going to be perhaps giving an analysis of it. I've asked him to, and maybe he will. And go check out David Rovick's website yourself to catch more of his weekly podcasts and songs. I do, or at least I do in order to pass them on to you, and I hope you do the same even when you're not listening to this show. So we'll end up with a final song called Busking in the Metaverse, another one by, of course, David Rovick's.
The hospitals are full to overflowing, every hallway lined with hospital beds. No one seems to know quite where we're going, cemeteries overloaded with the dead. My Wi-Fi is still working. I guess things could be worse. I'll be busking in the metaverse. You won't make someone sick out on the internet, at least not with a virus of that kind. You might be depressed or lonely, but as of yet, most likely you will find you won't have any need for a doctor or a nurse. Busking in the metaverse. There are famines going on in several countries, but not if you go dancing with the stars. On the internet, no one is hungry, or at least they have well-fed avatars, and they won't
across the street and clutch their purse. When I'm busking in the metaverse, there are armies lining up along the borders. You can have your wars, both cold and hot. Mercenaries following their orders. How much cryptocurrency you got? You can drop some in my case while I stand here and rehearse. Busking in the metaverse. Are all melting, forests are ablaze, toxic smoke blocking out the sun. So just put on your goggles, look at all the ways modern humans can have fun. It may be someone's salvation or a planetary curse, but I'll be busking in the metaverse. Busking in the metaverse. Busking in the metaverse.